Erev Tov, good evening, everyone. We'll get started now, and I apologize if we run through things a little quickly. I need to run a little early tonight, so we'll try to wrap up by about 8:05, so try to go as quickly as possible. All right, Erev Tov. Until now, we've been speaking a lot about... Does everyone have source sheets? Excellent. We've been speaking a lot about different facets of prophecy, and particularly last week, what does it take to be a prophet in Judaism? And we came up with a lot of different qualities. And tonight we're going to kind of use the information that we've developed until now and build on it to contradistinct the other prophets of Tanakh, of the Bible, and Moshe. I don't know if you remember, our first class we discussed how Rambam has several of his 13 principles of faith, several of Rambam's Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah, essential principles of faith, involve prophecy. And one of them is, first of all, to believe that prophecy exists, but another one is that Moshe stands above and beyond all other prophets. And that's extremely important for the Rambam. So we'll try to spend some time tonight, first of all, discovering what made Moshe different, what distinguishes him from other Nevi'im, and secondly, towards the end, we want to spend a little bit of time on why is that important? Why does that matter that Moshe is different than other prophets? Is this just to teach us how great Moshe was, or is there something deeper behind it? So we'll try to get there towards the end. And I think I left a hint for another question that we're going to try to explore tonight, which was a quality that we saw in the Rambam might be necessary for a prophet. And it's possible that Moshe was missing one of them. So we'll try to get to that and see, was Moshe really missing a quality? I don't want to give too much away from the beginning. If you remember it, then yasher koach. And if he was missing it, then how is that possible? And I guess now that we're actually talking about Maimonides and Moshe Rabbeinu in the same sentence, there's a famous, I think this was written on the Rambam, on Maimonides' grave. Mi Moshe le Moshe, from Moshe to Moshe, as in from Moshe Rabbeinu until Moshe, Moses Maimonides, as in the Rambam, lo haya, lo kam kemoshe, no one stood like Moshe. So the greatest compliment that the Jews of Egypt could pay, the Jews of Israel could pay to the Rambam, to Maimonides, because he was buried there, is that he was almost as great, or even maybe just as great as Moshe. So what made Moshe so great and so unique? And that's what we'll start with tonight. If you look at source one, we'll run through a few mikorot, a few sources in the Torah, which speak to Moshe's greatness as a Navi, as a prophet. So, V'diber Hashem el Moshe, God spoke to Moshe in Sefer Shmot, panim el panim, which means face-to-face, a direct encounter. Ka'asher yediber, just as a person can speak, ish el re'ehu, just as a person speaks to their friend, God spoke to Moshe. That's not a light sentence. That's quite a serious statement and assertion. And so that's extremely important, mostly because elsewhere in the Torah, Hashem says, and we'll discover this, we'll talk about this more later, that Hashem says, Ki lo yirani ha'adam, a person cannot see me, v'chai, and live. So if a person, if a human being cannot look at God and survive, whatever that means, then how can Moshe speak to Hashem, panim el panim? How is it possible? Right? Shouldn't Moshe die when he encounters God's face? And so that's a very, very serious statement that the Torah, that Hashem is making in the Torah. So another source where we see a similar expression, that one of the many times in source 2, after Am Yisrael continue to rebel repeatedly against Moshe, because they seem to do a lot of that in the Torah, Moshe says, right? We're Am K'shei Orif, a stick-necked people that seems to just can't get our game together, can't get our act together. And so after one of those many times, Hashem responds and he defends Moshe. He says, like, Am Yisrael, Jews, stop messing around. Like, do better. And what does Hashem say? Vayomer, God says, Shimu na dvarai, listen to my words. Im yeh nivyachem, if there are prophets among you, Hashem, I God, b'mar'eh elav et vadeh, will I God, it's a rhetorical question. I will make myself known to him in a mar'eh, in a vision. B'chalom adaber bo, I will speak to a prophet with a chalom, which is a dream. I'll speak to prophets with dreams. But here Hashem distinguishes, so it's not just Rambam, it's not just Maimonides who distinguishes Moshe from other prophets. But Hashem himself, hey there, Hashem himself distinguishes, peh el peh, I'm sorry, Lo chen avdi Moshe. My servant Moshe is not like any other prophet. That's God speaking. Bechol beiti ne'emanhu. For my entire house, right? God says, my entire world that belongs to me is my home. He is what? Ne'emanhu. He is the faithful one, more so than anyone else. Pe el pe adaber bo. Once again, it's not face to face, but rather mouth to mouth. But you see the same very direct, intimate exchange that exists between Hashem and with Moshe. Adaber bo. Umare. And here significantly, I speak to Moshe with a mare. What's a mare?
Vision.
A vision. Do you know mare can mean something else as well in Hebrew? Especially in Mishnah Hebrew, a mare can mean a mirror. So we'll get to that in a little bit.
To see.
You can see, right. So, and that's really significant. So Hashem says, I appear to Moshe in a mare, in a vision. And as opposed to, what did we say about other Nevi'im? Anyone remember from last week's class? Dreams, exactly. Thank you, Donna. And what else? We said that a Navi is given two pieces of a prophecy. A Navi, we said, is given a mashal, is given a parable, and then given a pitaron, a solution. Right? He's given two components, and then the Navi, the prophet, is meant to decode the message that's given to him. So there might be a dream, it's likely going to be a dream or a dreamlike state in which it takes place, but there will be some narrative or some image that's given to the prophet, and then the Navi, the prophet, has to decipher it and communicate that with whoever it's meant to be communicated with. But not Moshe. Moshe is given a maret, a direct vision. Velo b'chidot. Why? Because it's not a chidot. Chidot means a riddle. Other Nevi'im are given, as we said, some kind of message that they then have to decode. It's like a riddle, but not Moshe. And even more so, and here we could spend a lot of time talking about whether God has a physical image. The second to last line in the Hebrew and the third to last line in the English, Utmunat Hashem Yabit. He looks at the image of God. That's what it literally means. So just want to pause on that for a minute. How is it possible for a man to look at an image of God? Tmunat Hashem. Didn't we spend the Rambam so much? It is such a strong believer in the fact that God has no image, that as Jews, especially who follow the Rambam, we don't believe in an anthropomorphic God. So if that's the case, if you take that as a belief, then how can God have an image? So that I want to put that out as a question. Do you remember we discussed a possible answer to that a few classes ago? And it was a little bit of a mystical answer. But I want to return to it just quickly because it'll come up in a few of the later sources. So a few classes ago, we spoke about the idea that God creates an image that has certain similarities to himself in order to offer that to Nevi'im, to prophets. If you remember, we spoke about the word kavod, God's glory, and how there can be a kavod elyon and a kavod tachton, a higher glory and a lower glory. And God almost emanates a vision, or God emanates an image that is like God, but not necessarily God himself. It's either like God or it's of God. It might be like a ray that kind of shines through, but it's not the fullness of Hashem. And sometimes Hashem will provide an image to a Navi, but it's not actually Hashem. And we spoke about that, how Rav Sadia Gaon developed that idea first, and it was taken later by Hasidei Ashkenaz, by the pietists of Germany in the Middle Ages. But so there are ways to answer that question. So there you see Hashem rebukes the nation. Come on, you're not respecting Moshe? He is the greatest of prophets. He speaks to me pe al pe, mouth to mouth, right? He has seen my image, says Hashem. None of you will ever see my image going back, because if you see my image, you're going to die, not Moshe. And so lastly, as Moshe dies at the end of the Torah, in verse 3, we're told, and it's a tragic, I always cry when I get to the end of the Torah, as we're about to restart. Because I don't know, it's not even sad, but it's just so profound and such an intense moment in the Torah. So that as right as Moshe dies, the Torah says, V'lo kam navi od b'Yisrael. No other prophet ever stood in Israel, Kemoshe, like Moshe. There was no one else like Moshe. Asher yada'o Hashem, who knew God, panim el panim, face to face. So all those are instances where we're told that Moshe knew God better than anyone else. Moshe was a higher level prophet than anyone else. And how is that possible? Why is Moshe higher? And what does it mean that he was a higher level prophet? So if you look at source 4, we kind of set it outside. That's where the Rambam says that this is an Ikar Emunah. It's a foundation of our faith that Moshe was a higher level prophet than anyone else. But why is that important, and what does it mean? So any ideas? And then we'll keep going ourselves. We'll keep going through some of the notes. Why might it be important, first of all, for there to be one prophet who rises above the others? Is that important? Is that dangerous? Or is it not important?
Well, to me,
Dean.
There's this idea of being more authoritative.
Okay, excellent. And why might authority be important for someone like Moshe? Moshe had a very specific task that was above and beyond the task of other prophets. Right, the most difficult task. First of all, he had to form a people. Right, he had to take a group, an assembly of slaves, and make them into a nation that was able to live autonomously. That's a tremendous task. And secondly, he had to give something to the people that no other prophet had to give them. And that's the Torah. And I want to pause on that for now, but excellent, Dean. And we'll kind of go back to that a little bit later. So there's one amazing comment, and now kind of continuing with what made Moshe different, or how does the Talmud describe Moshe's difference? So if you look at source 3, there's a fascinating Gemara in Yevamot, in Tractate Yevamot, which says the following. So kol hanevi'im, the second word, all prophets nistaklu ba'aspaklaria she'ena me'ira. All other prophets looked through a mirror that was not me'ira. My wife's name is me'ira. So what does that mean? That means that was not literally shining. As in, they look through unclear, almost foggy mirrors. That's what other prophets look through. But what did Moshe look through? Moshe contrasts the Gemara. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher, nistakel ba'aspaklaria ha-me'ira. He looked through a mirror that was very clear. And it's a fascinating comment in the Gemara. Aspaklaria, actually, I used a book called Aspaklaria to prepare today's class. Aspaklaria, if you ever are looking for to do some heavy-duty research in Jewish thought, there's an encyclopedia of Jewish philosophy and Jewish Agadita called Aspaklaria. It's called the Great Mirror or Prism of Jewish Thought, and it has indexed by alphabetically hundreds, if not thousands, of different topics. Anyway, so that's a mirror. It's a prism into Jewish life. So Moshe had a different kind of prism, a different kind of way to look at Hashem. And we're not going to read it inside, but the Ramchal, Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, who's a great Kabbalist of the 16th century, he describes what it was like. If you want to read for yourselves, I'll describe it outside. For other prophets, what does it mean for another prophet to look through an aspaklaria she'ena mi'ira, a unclear, a foggy, or blurry mirror? So he first says that for other prophets, it wasn't just looking through one mirror. But imagine for yourselves, you have a room filled with many different mirrors that were all refracting kind of off each other and reflecting off each other. The image that I got when I was reading this is, imagine you're a prophet and you walk into a haunted house. You know that room in a haunted house which has all those different mirrors that kind of reflect off each other? So that's the first thing. There are a lot of different mirrors. And you're kind of getting a sense of an image that's far away that's being refracted or reflected through many different mirrors, one to another, to another, to another. And as that process takes place, you're seeing rays of light, perhaps, that are coming towards you, but you're not seeing any full image. And yet, I don't know, has anyone else been into those haunted house rooms? You can kind of tell if there's a person standing on the other side, let's say that kind of fake ghost that's about to jump out, right? And you can tell that it's one person or one being that's moving on the other side, but it's so refracted that you can't make out an image. Right? You're seeing little bits and pieces from all these different mirrors and all these different shards of glass that are reflecting off each other. So that's the first thing that the Ramchal says as he describes this foggy mirror that other prophets had. He says it's really many mirrors. And furthermore, they're not clear. So you're basically looking through a bunch of fogged up or refracted glass, and that's the experience that other Nevi'im had. What does that mean, practically speaking? This is how the Talmud describes looking at Hashem. So according to the Ramchal, it's this very cryptic process. You're looking at something, and you know it's there. Because as it moves, or as it tries to tell you something, you're experiencing it. Just like you could see little pieces of a person in this haunted house as you look through all these different pieces of glass. But you never see the full image. Right? You never see the big picture, right? And whatever you do see is not clear. It's fogged. It's Eina Me'ira. That's the experience of a Navi when they encounter Hashem. Just like, and that's following, this is kind of the Talmud's explanation of what it means not to be panim el panim, not to be face to face. But the Gemara says, does the Gemara say that Moshe saw Hashem face to face? I think the Gemara is kind of toning down what the Chumash seems to imply, what the Torah seems to imply. Because the Torah says, right, and even Hashem in the Torah says, Moshe sees me panim el panim, like mamash, right, face to face. But the Gemara is saying there was one mirror, right? There was a clear mirror. So even Moshe did not actually see a complete vision of God. However, says the Ramchal, and this is the bold in the Hebrew, he contradistincts Moshe from the Nevi'im, that what he had only one mirror to look through, right? For Moshe, it was, imagine kind of, you have a mirror at a 45-degree angle, and you're looking at the mirror. So he sees God through one mirror, and that mirror is not foggy. It's very clear. So Moshe didn't see Hashem in his entirety, and yet he could perceive a full picture, not like these many shards of different glass, right? It's one complete picture, one complete image, metaphorically speaking, of Hashem. And that image that he did perceive was not foggy either, and that's important. Yeah, Pauline. Oh, excellent. Is anyone else familiar with this?
Yep.
So, yeah, so the Torah says, and this is right after, in Sefer Shemot, right after Moshe asked for forgiveness, yes, after the Jewish people sinned with Cheta Egel, with the sin of the golden calf, and Moshe says, you know, V'salach t'la amazeh, please forgive this nation. Then Hashem says, "Et panai lo yireh, v'achorai tirah," right? God says, you won't see my front, but you'll see my back. So it's possible that might be what the Talmud is working on, right? That Hashem didn't see the entirety of God or God in his essence. He kind of saw a refraction of God looking backwards. Just a beautiful lesson that I've learned from that pasuk. And this is a little off topic. But when you look and you try to understand, see Hashem, panim, facing forward, right? Looking at the present, it's impossible to see Hashem. But when you've passed the difficulties that we experience in life, right, when I'm facing difficulties at the moment, I can't see Hashem. But v'acharai, afterwards, right, when you go forward, you pass the difficulty, and then you look back, then you can see Hashem. That's the acharai tirah. You can see me after. You can see my back. Right, once you've gone through it all, then you can look backwards and see almost the face of God.
So panim el panim is face to face.
So maybe that's a way to explain it.
We are seeing each other. Uh-huh.
So with Hashem, it's almost, but it's not quite. And here's how I understand it, based on something we discussed a few classes ago, which was the Kavod Elyon and the Kavod Tachton, the higher glory of Hashem and the lower glory of Hashem. We spoke, I know it got a little detailed and a little nuanced, but there were two definitions of God's emanation. The rationalist view of how prophets can see God is that God creates an image that's not really Hashem, it's not really God, but it resembles qualities of God. Do you remember how some of us talked about this? So God creates an image. So let's say when Isaiah sees God as he stands above the Heichal, above the temple, in the sixth chapter of Isaiah. So let's say Rav Sadia Gaon, and we spoke about this a few classes ago, Rav Sadia Gaon would say that God was creating an image of himself, which he then planted in the brain of Yeshayah. And so Yeshayah was not really seeing Hashem. He was seeing an image created by Hashem for the purpose of teaching Isaiah lessons about God. So that's what the rationalist school of thought would say about prophecy. The Kabbalists, though, say that it's different. There is a Kavod Elyon, this upper glory of Hashem, that then is refracted to a lower glory of Hashem that most prophets can perceive. But what's different, though, is that it's not an image, a higher image of God, and then a lower image of God that's not really God, but that's just created by God. So that's not what it is. But rather, for the Mekubalim, for the Kabbalists, what they do experience is an emanation of God. that you have these rays of Hashem's essence, of God's essence, that almost come and emanate into a lower form, or a more gashmi, a more physical form, and then even into a form below that. But when you experience a prophecy, according to the Mekubalim, you're experiencing an emanation, some of the original rays of Hashem. At least for me, just going back to the Gemara that we saw, when you have a mirror, right? When you have a mirror, let's say Moshe had a very clear mirror. When a ray of light travels and hits a mirror, it continues. It's the same ray, right? So I think that's what the Gemara is saying, and that's at least how the Mekubalim would understand it. That what Hashem's essence travels through a mirror, it's emanated, it's passed on. As that process happens, it's a little bit more discreet, right? It's a little less bright, but it's still a piece, it's still a chelek elokah. It's still a little piece of God, or a ray of God's light. Okay, excellent. Any other questions about this Gemara? About the idea that Moshe saw Hashem through one clear mirror, but the other prophets saw Hashem either through one very foggy mirror, or according to the Ramchal, through many, many foggy mirrors, like a haunted house kind of vision. So that was one statement from the Talmud that differentiates Moshe from other prophets. So before we go on, I want to look at Source 8, and we'll just talk about Source 8 outside. Because Rambam categorizes five differences. I thought there were five differences between Moshe and other prophets. So I think Rambam is kind of basing himself on the Gemara and also basing himself on Psukim, on verses. So we'll just go through them outside. The first one is, as opposed to other prophets, and we saw this in the Torah itself, God speaks to Moshe directly, not through intermediaries. What might an intermediary be? Who exists between God and prophets, if God's going to have an intermediary?
Angels.
So for the Rambam, there are angels that communicate messages from Hashem to humans, to prophets. Moshe, though, did not require an angel. And we'll try to understand how that's possible. Okay? So that's difference number one. Difference number two, other prophets were told, experienced a chalom, which is a dream. Other prophets had to be asleep or in a sleep-like state to experience nevuah. Moshe, however, could be walking down the street and very much awake and involved in his day-to-day activities, and still be receiving messages from Hashem and talking back to Hashem at the same time. So that's another difference that differentiates Moshe from other Nevi'im. Third, we spoke about this a few classes ago, that as a prophet would experience prophecy, they would almost go into what might look like their hands would start shaking, their bodies would start shaking, they'd lose control over their bodies, which kind of works in tandem with the dreamlike state. They were not in control of their bodies. Moshe, however, as he talked to Hashem, as he had nevuah, would remain in control of his body. For other Nevi'im, we spoke about why might that happen, because nevuah is experiencing something that's beyond the physical, right? It's experiencing spiritual, something that's very purely spiritual. To experience something purely spiritual, one almost has to disconnect themselves, right, from the physical. And so as a Navi experiences something ethereal, they lose control over their physical part, which is their body, as they become more in touch with their soul. So that's at least one interpretation. Fourthly, another difference. Moshe could receive nevuah on tap, right? He could just turn it on and it would be there, and then he could turn it off and it would stop. Other Nevi'im had no control when God actually chose to talk to them. What's an example of this in the Torah? Bilam, the evil prophet, right? Hashem comes to Bilam in a dream. And then when Bilam wants to kind of tap into God and curse the Jewish people, it doesn't work out the way he wanted, right? If God was in control of Bilam's access to prophecy. But Hashem almost opens the doors up to Moshe and says, whenever you want to talk, I'm here. So that's another difference. And the last one, and in a sense, this is important both in terms of understanding how Moshe's prophecy was different, and also it reveals a window into Moshe's life. If you look at difference number five, that other Nevi'im, they would have to be in a state of purity when they would encounter Nevuah. And yet Moshe, though, when a Navi had a prophecy, they had to be in a state of purity. But afterwards, they could, let's say, as the Rambam says, chozrim le'ohalam, they could return to their tents. They could go home. And part of that would be that they could engage in marital relations, that they could, sexual activity is not a bad thing in Judaism, but a person would have to purify themselves from, and probably go to a mikvah or something like that before they can encounter Hashem with Nevuah. Moshe, though, as opposed to other prophets, once he started being the leader of Am Yisrael, he actually separated from Tzipporah, from his wife, and according to the Rambam, he never returned to Tzipporah. So he actually lived a life as an ascetic, I guess, that would be the word. Does Hashem want us to be ascetics?
No.
No, generally not. We're supposed to be part of the world. We're supposed to enjoy the world within the context of mitzvot, within the context of commandments. You know, Hashem, there's a Gemara that says any forbidden food in the world, there's a kosher food that closely resembles it. And Don might not, I don't know, maybe. Okay. Okay. No, so that there's a Gemara that says that. I'm sorry for calling you out. My bad. So there's a Gemara that says that, and I think philosophically that's true about many things, right? Sex is permitted in Judaism within a certain context, right? And food's permitted in Judaism within a certain context. And that's true about almost anything you can think about within Judaism for almost everyone. The exception is Moshe. The exception is Moshe. That Moshe totally relinquished his physical desires and the parts of himself that made him human, right? Sex is something that makes us human, and Moshe gave up on that. And why is that important? That's important because if you go back to source 7, the Maharal of Prague asked the question that we posed before, which was, if Hashem says that no one can see me and live, right, ki lo yirani hadam v'chai, then Moshe apparently did see God. Or if he didn't see God exactly, he saw a very close resemblance of God, right? So how could Moshe then survive? And so the Maharal's response is that Moshe, what makes man and humanity incapable of experiencing Hashem directly and living is that there's a physical part of ourselves. And while the spiritual part of ourselves, right, the neshama that exists within a person, while that is totally attuned to experiencing God, right, the physical part of ourselves is not as attuned to experiencing God. So much so that if Hashem's full spirituality, or if God's full expression finds itself upon a person who's too attached to their physical being, what happens? The physical being almost gets let go, gets unattached. That's our bodies. So when a Navi experiences Hashem too strongly, then they might die. And that would be the experience of Hashem Panim El Panim. Where do we see this according to the Midrash? We see this at the giving of the Ten Commandments, which is what? God starts speaking to the Jewish people, and according to the Midrash, for the first two commandments, God speaks directly to the people, and the people die. And then according to the Midrash, God has to revive the people, revive Am Yisrael. Why? Because if you're attached to your physical body, you can't experience sublime spirituality without almost one's physicality being totally disconnected, and that happens through death. Moshe, however, purified himself so much that, according to the Maharal, he gave up on his physicality. That's Moshe who separated from Tzipporah and was never with her again. Right? That's Moshe who totally gave up on his body even while he lived in this world. And that's why, according to the Maharal, Moshe could experience Hashem on that much of a higher level. So that's what separated Moshe from other prophets. Okay, excellent. A few other points. We mentioned last week, if you look in source 9, that in addition to all the other qualities of being a Navi, of being a prophet, there was another one. We didn't really count it in our list of 7 qualities of being a prophet, but it was the quality of shalem begufo, of being shalem, whole, begufo, in one's body. So the simple understanding of that is that a person has to be physically healthy and physically complete. And so if you look, an example, how do we know this? That's what it means, shalem begufo. So reference from this week's Parsha in sources 10 and 11. So in this week's Parsha, we first have the fight between Jacob, and an angel, right? So this is Yaakov. Yaakov crosses the river to go back and try to find something on his own. We're told, according to the Midrash, it's some pachim ketanim. He has some jugs of oil that he goes back for. We mentioned earlier at Minyan today that Vayishlach is always read right around Hanukkah. And what did the Jews find? What was the miracle that the Jews of Hanukkah? The Jews found a pach ktana, a small jug of oil. And we read right around the same time in Parsha Vayishlach that Yaakov found these pachim ktanim, some small vessels of oil. I think it's an interesting connection. I forget what the meaning is behind it, but hopefully we'll explore that at some point in the near future. So Yaakov goes, and then as he crosses the river on his own, Vayeavik ish imo, an angel or some human form comes and fights with him, adalota shachar, until the morning. Yaakov has this fight with an angel, and who wins in the fight?
Jacob.
Yaakov wins. But, Yaakov wins, then the angel blesses him and says, your name is now going to be Israel and not just Jacob anymore. But Yaakov is left with an injury, and that his thigh is injured. And yet, later in this week's parsha, in source 10, when Yaakov comes back to Israel, to the city of Shechem, the way the Torah writes it is Vayavo Yaakov Shalem. Yaakov comes back to the Ir Shechem, Shalem, which means, Shalem means complete. It means complete, and according to Rashi in source 11, Rashi actually gives a few expressions. The first is Shalem Begufo, that he's saved, and what does Rashi say? He was cured of his limp. The angel injured his foot, and somehow he was cured of that injury. Another interpretation that Rashi quotes from the Gemara is that he was Shalem B'mamono. Yaakov paid a lot of money to Esav. He gave him a lot of gifts. Apparently he was repaid for those gifts, I think by Hashem or some other way. And the third one was Shalem B'torato. He was Shalem in his knowledge of Torah. Because Yaakov had gone on this long journey, and yet, according to the Gemara, he never forgot the Torah that he had learned. So that's at least another interpretation. Yeah, Pauline.
Can you kindly give the interpretation of Israel?
Oh, excellent. So I think the Pasuk says, Yasharta im Kel. I think you fought with some...
It's good for all of us to know why it's Yaakov Israel. Why is it?
Sure. So I think the explanation in the Pashut Pshat, in the simple reading of the Pesukim, is that you fought with God, the Hitzlachta, I think, right? And you succeeded. There are a lot of interpretations of this narrative. One of them is that the Malach was a representative of Esav. Was a representative of Esav, who was like kind of the spiritual embodiment of Esav. And Yaakov was fighting against, basically, his spiritual enemy or nemesis. And he conquered his spiritual nemesis. And at that point, he was able to rise to a higher level in which the name of God, right, El, was included into his name. So you fought and you were able to kind of bring God into your life by fighting against your spiritual nemesis. That's one interpretation. I'm sure there are many more. Okay, excellent. And yeah, maybe it's a topic for this Shabbat. So I'll have to start thinking about it. Except actually Rabbi Dardik's here, so he'll be talking. So just quickly, and we'll kind of wrap up in the next 10 minutes or so. So a person has to be, according to the Rambam, to be a prophet, one has to be shalem begufo, which is complete in their body. And we see, according to Rashi, shalem begufo, that expression means physically well, not having a physical, any kind of impairment. Why might that be an issue for Moshe? Moshe is a stutter. Excellent. So we're told when Hashem first comes to Moshe, excellent. When Hashem first comes to Moshe, what does Moshe respond? God, I really want to be your shaliach. I really want to save Am Yisrael. However, kaved peh v'chaved lashon. I am heavy of mouth and heavy of tongue. That would be probably the most literal translation. The Midrash explains, what does that mean? So according to the Midrash, and this is a story that it's kind of one of those stories that children books can discuss from time to time, but it's a real Midrash, is that when Moshe was very young, he was taken in by Bat Paro, by Paro's daughter, into the palace of Paro. And according to the Midrash, Paro really loved Moshe. And so much so that he would play with him, the Midrash says he would kiss him on the cheek, and even so much that he would place his crown upon Moshe's head. So but Paro didn't know that Moshe was a Jew. And so what would happen? The Chartumei Mitzrayim, the Egyptian necromancers, the magicians of Egypt, they started kind of picking up signals. And they told Paro, beware, Paro, we feel that this person might take your throne, might take your crown, the crown that Paro was putting on Moshe's head. And so Paro gets very concerned. According to the Midrash, at that moment, and here this is definitely a complexity, Yitro walks in, Jethro, Moshe's father-in-law. What was Yitro doing there? Right? right? So I think there's a Gemara that says that Paro had a few trusted advisors, one of whom was Yitro. The Gemara says another one, if I'm not mistaken, was Eov. Was Eov, the English word is Job. Yeah. So Job, who seemingly has no connection, even dating Sefer Eov, trying to find when Sefer Eov was written, there's one interpretation in the Gemara that Eov lo haya velo yia. Eov never lived. But it's just kind of a narrative to teach us something about, really, I guess, dealing with bad experiences, etc. But that is one interpretation, that Eov, Yitro, and there was another person as well who didn't fit in there. Oh, Bilam. Apparently, Bilam was also, there were three advisors to Paro. And I think this Midrash is working with that. So Yitro steps in as the necromancers, as the magicians were telling Paro, this guy might take your crown, we think you should kill him. Yitro steps in and says, you know what? Let's do a test. Yitro responds, Ein lo dat. This little kid, he's not a smart aleck. Right? Actually, he's quite dumb. That's what Yitro says. And what should you do? Place a coal, a burning hot coal, and place a little piece of gold in front of him, and let's see which one he goes for. And I guess, I don't know if Yitro was being good to Paro and really wanted to decide, or if he was secretly trying to help Moshe, but according to the Midrash, Moshe starts to stick out his hand. They do this. Moshe starts sticking out his hand towards the gold. Following the Midrash, the Malach Gabriel, the angel Gabriel, grabs Moshe's hand, forces it to touch the coal, forces it to take the coal and put it in his mouth, kind of to show Paro and his magicians that this kid's really not a threat. He's kind of dumb, right? And so at that moment, that's how the Midrash explains that Moshe becomes Kaved Peh v'Kaved Lashon, right? How Moshe loses his ability to teach, to speak clearly. And at that moment, that's Moshe's greatest excuse to Hashem for why he shouldn't be the leader. And what's God's response? I decide who talks, right? I can give anyone the power of speech and take away the power of speech from anyone. So all that being said, being Kaved Peh v'Kaved Lashon, if that really means a stutter, then it's very possible that Moshe is not Shalem B'Gufo, that Moshe is not full-bodied or is not unimpaired. So then how can Moshe be a Navi if that's an absolute necessity, if that's a quality of being a Navi, and Moshe doesn't have that quality of being Shalem B'Gufo, then how can Moshe not only be a prophet, but the greatest of prophets? Everyone hear the question? Okay. So two possible answers. The first is what I think is an amazing midrash. It's kind of a technical answer, which is that it's true Moshe was stuttered, did have a stutter. However, there's a pasuk in Mishle that says, Marpeh Lashon Eitz Chaim, which literally means he who is of soft tongue, a person who speaks softly, so doesn't yell, doesn't use harsh words, is an Eitz Chaim, is a tree of life. The way of life is to speak softly. That's the simple reading of the pasuk. But what else can an Eitz Chaim represent? Eitz Chaim hi l'machazikim ba. When we take back the Torah, we sing, this is the tree of life for those who hold on to it. So according to the Midrash, Marpeh Lashon, Marpeh is the word Rafa or Rofe. The healer of one's lashon, one's tongue, is Eitz Chaim, is the tree of life, as in Torah. When a person studies Torah, their tongue or their ability to speak is healed. That's the Midrash. So what happens? Moshe was actually incapable of speaking. He had a very significant stutter. And yet when he started studying Torah, at some point during the process of God selecting him, he actually got healed, and he lost his stutter very early on. Another interpretation that's offered by others, not by Midrash, later sources, is that, you know what? Moshe had a stutter? That's true. And actually, a Navi is supposed to be Shalem B'Gufo, is supposed to not have any impairments? That's true too. But you know what? Hashem made a conscious exception to his rule. God broke his rule for Moshe. And he wanted Moshe, he wanted his prophet of prophets, to have a stutter, And I saw two different reasons. So the first is that Moshe, according to a book called the Sefer Peh Kadosh, the Book of One's Holy Mouth, I don't know where it's from, but Moshe was incapable of pronouncing the letter Peh, or a P in English. P is pronounced with one's tongue, right? Kavod Peh, the Kavod Lashon. The Gemara, there's actually a Midrash that kind of tries to analyze which sounds was Moshe incapable of making based on which sounds are made with one's mouth, which sounds are made with one's lips. So at least according to Kaved Lashon, I think this is Kaved Peh. Anyways, the Midrash says that he couldn't pronounce a P. And what Hashem tells him, go to Am Yisrael and tell them, Pakod Pakadati. God says, I have remembered you. And when Am Yisrael, they know that Moshe is a stutterer. And then they're going to hear him say the words Pakod Pakadati, and God is going to bless him to say it properly and not with his stutter. Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, will then know God has performed a miracle for Moshe, has helped him at that moment overcome his stutter. And then that's a siman, that's a sign to Am Yisrael that really this Moshe guy is sent from Hashem. So that's one interpretation. Hashem wanted him to have a stutter so that at that moment he could stop the stutter and everyone would know this is a miracle that Hashem is providing, just so that we know Moshe is the real deal. So that's one interpretation. I think at least a deeper one from the Drashot Haran that I saw quoted from a friend of mine, right, David Weinberg, who's a great teacher of Torah. So the Ran says that, you know, Hashem wanted Moshe to have a stutter. And you know why? Because Hashem didn't want Am Yisrael to accept the Torah because they had this really charismatic leader who was a great orator. Right? Hashem wanted Am Yisrael to accept the Torah despite the fact that their leader wasn't so convincing when he spoke because he had a stutter. Right? He wanted us basically to accept Torah for what it is and not because there was some fancy talker who could convince them to do it. And that's why he specifically chose a person like Moshe, or he specifically endowed Moshe with a stutter, because he wanted Am Yisrael to accept the Torah lishma for the right reasons and not for the wrong ones. So there's, I guess, two different answers to this question of how could Moshe be a prophet if Moshe had a stutter. The first one is that Hashem healed the stutter. And the second one is that Hashem actually consciously chose Moshe and made an exception to his rule, either to prove a miracle to the Jewish people so that they would know that Moshe is the real deal, or because Hashem really wanted them to choose the Torah and everything that the Torah represented with Moshe, not for because Moshe was so convincing, but because it was real and it was a Torah temet, it was a Torah of truth. Okay, so we've seen a lot about Moshe. I just want to follow up on why does it matter? Why does it matter that Moshe is above all other prophets? And to answer that, I saw a beautiful quotation from Rabbi Yaakov Weinberger in a book called Fundamentals and Faith. And what Rabbi Yaakov Weinberger says, and this is so important, is that Moshe had a unique role. I think, Hank, you were kind of saying this before. If I'm not mistaken, either Hank or Dean, I forget. I saw you guys sitting next to each other. So why does it matter for Moshe to be above all other prophets? Right, to the point, as we started this year, that this is one of the Yud Gimel Ikari Emuna. For Rama, this is one of the 13 principles of faith. Why it matters is because Moshe's role was different. Any other Navi, they never had to transmit teaching of truth, which is Torah. Moshe had to actually transfer a higher level of Nevuah. So not only was Moshe a higher prophet, but the words that Moshe was told to communicate were higher level prophecy. And I just want to end with this quotation. The prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, which was validated through a unique moment in history, the revelation of to the entire nation of Israel, that prophecy of Moshe is Torah. Torah represents the absolute truths of the Almighty, directly communicated to man. In contrast, as opposed to Moshe, the prophecy of all other prophets is not Torah. So indeed, their prophecy is validated only through criteria established by Torah. What we saw, I think, in last week's shiur, that Hashem tells you through Torah how to know if someone's a real prophet, right? The test, the litmus test, is given in the Torah. So any words that a Navi is going to teach us is lower than the Torah, because we know whether or not to believe them from the words of the Torah itself, right? It's disseminated through the Torah. So in certain cases, prophecy was granted in order to deliver a message to a community or to the nation. So these messages served as a source of insight or inspiration regarding the teachings of Torah. So they helped us direct how to understand Torah, but they weren't Torah themselves. However, these communications never innovated any Torah commandment. I think our first shiur, or second shiur, we discussed how could a Navi teach something that was never known before. The Torah has a prohibition of Baal Tosif. We're not allowed to add anything to the words of Torah. So if that's the case, how can a prophet say something new? And we had a few different answers. The essence of them were that a Navi can help us ameliorate and improve our practice of Torah, but a Navi can never teach us something new that was not originally in the Torah. Moshe, though, had the greatest and perhaps most difficult challenge in Jewish history, which was how to teach Torah and how to disseminate Torah to the Jewish nation. This is the essence of what it means to be a Jew, and furthermore, it's the essence of how to connect to God in this world. Right? As we mentioned before, the Zohar says, the book of mysticism called the Zohar, that Kucha Brichu Voraita, God and his Torah, Chadhu, is one. That if we want to understand God, we get there by learning Torah. But by learning Torah. How could God disseminate that book of Torah, those teachings of Torah, that are in essence almost an emanation of Hashem himself? That requires the most capable and the most holy prophet who ever lived. Because the prophecy that he had to convey was above and beyond any other nevuah ever given. And that is why it's so crucial for Moshe to be an ascetic, right, as opposed to other prophets. And that's why it's so crucial for Moshe to be able to see God, Basbaklaria Mi'ira, right, through that clear mirror. If Moshe was going to give over the teachings of Hashem, which in some way are an emanation of God himself, then Moshe had to understand God better than any other prophet who ever lived. And so that's what separates, and that's why it's important that Moshe is separated from all other Nevi'im. Thank you so much for coming. Erev Tov. Shikamach.